Yeah, you can, you can continue submitting me solutions on this thing.
Because I've enjoyed Black metal.
But I'm expecting the PV guys to bring some sense to all this at some point.
Well, I just turned mine in, so it's not for good result.
I haven't tested that.
If nothing else, you could call some of those great PV analog engineers and make
them. Yeah, I started to do that.
I used to.
So I shouldn't have raised. We were talking before class. Fortunately, there's agreement that this circuit cannot produce gain, right? So this is V in, and this is V out. V out is R2 over R1 plus R2, and R1 plus R2 has to be less than or equal to R2. So therefore, R2 over R1 plus R2 is less than 1. So that's the kind of rock-solid argument from the analytical side that I'm looking for. Now, some people, I think, did a pretty good job, but I get the feeling like if I put your pen to your head and said, is your solution correct? Like, no, I didn't really mean that. And that's ultimately what engineering is all about. At some point in your lives, you've had these great opportunities where everything will hinge on your answer to a question. And you lose a lot of sleep over it. Half of the time you'll be wrong, but you'll remember those stories and you'll tell them to your grandchildren.
The time Joe Piccone held a gun to my head and asked me about RLC circuits.
Back when education was free and then.
Yeah.
How many of you have taken oral exams at the whiteboard, you know, in front of a professor? In some schools, when you do your PhD qualifier, it's an oral exam, so the professors get you up to the whiteboard. This is a really interesting exercise in humiliation, because you know their whole goal in life is to just make that as a miserable process for you, to make you look as stupid, and I had to do actually an electromagnetics exam that way. And if you know electromagnetics, if you remember point charges and things, you can create a lot of really cool little problems. And by the end of that, I used to teach electromagnetics as a grad student, so then I took my qualifier, and they said, well, since you teach it, let's have a little bit of fun here. By the end of about 20 minutes with one of our professors, I was so twisted around that, I was like, just, look,
I had 8 professors sitting in a room with me for an hour, drilling me on anything in the 4 years that I had taken.
Yeah.
Definitely
nerve-wracking. But it's experiences like that that sort of build you, strengthen your ability to perform under fire. And that's really, I think, what one of the important things about exams that gets lost is we're helping you learn how to perform under pressure. It's not we're here just to torture you.
It's not.
Because in the real world, we were talking about at the end of last class, time to decision is important, and you're going to make a lot of decisions in your lives, in your technical lives, where you don't have all the information you need. There's nothing worse than working with people. I've worked with a lot of really smart people, but these are people who need to know everything before they'll answer a question, and then you just never know that. Most decisions you'll make in life, and this is why you'll be paid big bucks, is to make decisions based on your intuitions. Because you never have enough time to study the problem to the point where the answer is obvious. Most of the time, the information doesn't exist.
I don't know. I'm going to say that's bad business. That if you make guesses without knowing anything, the people in product development will halt you too, even though they might be impossible. And they'll never forget it.
True.
Like, anytime you make an argument, they're going to remember the time that you were wrong when you guessed when you didn't know that one thing.
But in real-world engineering problems, you never know everything you need to know. It's never y is equal to x. There's always unknown variables.
So the moral here is make our guess, but never, ever tell marketing.
Well, I thought you were going to talk about marketing people. So marketing people scare me. I mean, the marketing people go to customers, and the customer will say, I want this RLC circuit that produces a gain of 100. Oh, sure, no problem. I'll talk to my technical people. We got really sharp technical people, right? Yeah. So then they come back to the technical people. Who's somebody here from Adtran? Adtran used to have a lot of great stories about this. If anyone here was co-opted Adtran? So Adtran used to have a really aggressive marketing staff.
They got a 6-point GPA working together.
And then, you know, they'd sit with the engineers. They'd come back from these marketing trips, and they'd sit with the engineers, and there'd be a lot of screaming and yelling because the marketing people would promise anything to make a sale. That's their job.
Yep. We can get your packets there before we send them.
But a lot of, I think, what you'll learn as you get out in engineering is a lot of engineering is funded through a process where you propose projects, and then you do the work to find out if that thing is actually feasible.
So you just got to get somebody to believe in you enough to support your
team. To support your habit, is what we call it. So, particularly on the research side, but even internal developments and things, you're going to promise your management, if they give you some money, you can develop some product that they're going to eventually make money on, or some capability. And it's all, and you never know, I mean, half the time you're lying. I mean, you're trying to convince them to give them money, but you don't really know whether this is feasible or not. That's part of what engineering is all about. Solving new problems, working open-ended problems, and things like that. So you'll never know everything. And ultimately, you are going to have to rely on your intuitions. And that's why your undergraduate education is so important. And that's why your physics classes are so important. Because you're supposedly learning about how the, you know, the world works. You're building up those intuitions so that when somebody comes to you and with that, what are the machines called that create energy from nothing?
No, perpetual
motion machines. And believe me, in your career, you're going to see a lot of proposals for perpetual motion machines.
Some of them get patents.
A lot of them get patents. And especially these days with all the emphasis on energy and things like that. And your manager's going to turn to you and say, you know, you're the expert, you tell me. And you're going to look at it and you're going to try it. You know, you won't have infinite amounts of time to analyze properties of the system.
What you do is you trick your boss into thinking the answer you give is actually his idea.
Well, that's true of a lot of things when dealing with management.
So did you say that one time?
That's a good rule of in general dealing with your management. Anytime you look smarter than your boss, that's generally a guarantee you're not going to get promoted. And because you know your boss wants to get promoted, and if you look smarter, you might take their job someday. So there's this whole thing about making your management look like they're the smart ones, even though we all know they're the idiots. Okay, so let's talk today. Actually, this is a sort of a lecture you'll relate to, having worked on that problem a little bit. Let's talk about Bode plots and filters. And this is another one of those topics that Bode plots were really important in the days when we didn't have really good visualization and computational tools for circuits. They're still important today because they give us some insight into the basic properties of certain types of circuits. But as a plotting tool and such, they're not nearly as important as they used to be. So let's revisit a first-order system. Recall the transfer function for a first-order system in the upper left. H of s is equal to 1 over tau plus divided by s plus 1 over tau. And tau could be related to the resistance and capacitance, 1 over RC, or RC, that kind of thing. And we know that the real part of s is greater than minus 1 over tau, and we also know the stability issues if the pole is in the left half plane and such. So that circuit, or that transfer function, has an impulse response. What is the impulse response? What is the h of t that corresponds to this? If you take the inverse Laplace transform for this, it's an exponential, right? So we get an h of t, which is right here. 1 over tau e to the minus t over tau u of t. And you've seen this written in terms of r's and c's when we're working with circuits. But this is just a first order differential equation. This is the impulse response. And it has this exponential decay. And therefore, we can talk about the amount of time that it takes to drop in amplitude by 1 over e, and that's what you often call the half-life or the time constant. So the frequency response of this system, and that was one thing I noticed on the solutions, that some people started down this path, but I don't really feel like they sort of completed it in a great amount of detail. They sort of jumped to some conclusions and things, but we can look at the frequency response of the system by setting S equal to J omega and writing 1 over tau divided by J omega plus 1 over tau. We can then take the magnitude of that function, and that's just 1 over tau divided by the magnitude of omega squared plus 1 over tau squared. And we could ask the question, can the gain of this transfer function be greater than 1? Well, if you wanted to answer that question, here's the transfer function. The question that you simply have to ask is there a value of omega and a value of tau for which this thing can have a gain greater than 1?
No.
Because?
Because you're adding omega to 1 over omega, essentially, and so your denominator is always greater than your numerator.
Exactly.
Or greater than or equal.
Exactly.
When you square J omega, like, why is that not negative omega squared?
The magnitude of this is the real part squared plus the imaginary part squared.
You're only looking at the magnitude of the imaginary part. So it's Re of Z plus Im of Z, and so you drop the J.
Yeah, because this is actually, thank you, this is actually a complex number, A plus JB.
Okay, so that's what's going on. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
it's
happening
there.
Because if you
I
were actually...
I just took it as truth when I was looking at the book.
So this is a complex number.
If you actually squared it, you'd end up with three terms.
So you can think of this as a vector that has a real part of 1 over tau, an imaginary part of omega. So the magnitude of this vector is 1 over tau squared plus omega squared. That's square root of that. So if omega is equal to 0, this has a value of 1. If omega is equal to 1 over tau, this has a value of 1 over the square root of 2. If omega is very, very large, the sum of these two is essentially omega squared, and this has a value of 1 over tau over omega. That gives us some idea of what the frequency response looks like. It starts at 1, it drops to 1 over the square root of 2, and then it continues to drop linearly with omega. We have the impulse response here. This is actually the step response of this circuit, and we've seen that. We worked with that problem last class. You see the exponential rise to the steady state value of 1. And in the S-plane, we can write this as a system which has a single pole here at minus 1 over tau. And we talked about the fact that the frequency response is what you get when you walk along the J omega axis. But we had some discussion at the end of the last class that I wanted to reinforce here. When I draw this picture of the imaginary, the complex plane with an X here for the pole, what does this really represent? This is a visualization. This is a sort of an approximation to a complex function. What does that complex function really look like?
It's the output's like goes to infinity at that pole.
So this is a plot of the magnitude of H of J omega, right?
Right.
The height off the screen is the magnitude of H of J omega. That's the Z, that's the third dimension. Because this is a complex number in general. So we talk about the magnitude of H of J omega. And when I put this X here, that's essentially the peak of the mountain. There's essentially a mountain sitting here, right? So when you walk along the J Omega axis here, what's happening as you're walking by this mountain?
You're kind of going over the foothills of it.
Right. You're walking along, and then you're going to go up a little because the mountain will spill over past the J Omega axis. So you're going to go like that. Now, depending on how close this is to the axis or how broad the peak is, you're going to go up and down a different amount of height. But clearly, when you're at this point, when you're at frequency equals zero, you're going to be at the highest point along the side of the mountain. So and then you're going to go down from there. So the response is just going to be kind of a low-pass response.
And since the pole is actually on the real axis, that means our greatest gain is happens at DC, right?
Right. So what happens if I move the pole here?
Get bandpass speed.
I get a bandpass filter. But how do I get a bandpass filter with only one pole?
Because, well, I mean, there has to be a complex conjugate.
No. What happens if I move? If I have a system which just has a pole here, what do you know about that system?
Well, I mean, if you walk up the imaginary axis, that peak of the foothill, I guess, is going to be related up and a higher frequency.
Yes, right, you're absolutely
frequency
right.
Shifting.
So if this is a real pole, this could be, for example, the complex pole. One complex pole.
Is it
but
possible?
If there's one complex pole, what must be true about that transfer function?
It has to have a complex conjugate pole, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't have to.
It should. If it's a real
but
system,
it
should.
If it's a real system. So if there's just one complex pole, what's true about that complex that transfer function? It's complex, right? The coefficients, this coefficient is not going to be a real number. This is going to be a complex number.
Oh, and
which means it's not a circuit, because we haven't quite figured out how to have resistors that have complex values. But
what about resistors?
What?
resistors?
Maybe I don't. It's but typically we have polynomials that have real coefficients. So whenever we have a complex pole, we're going to have a complex conjugate pole. So sometimes when you deal with things like single sideband modulation, you will see complex transfer functions. But generally when you're dealing with circuits and things, you'll always have these complex conjugate poles.
Is that something that can only happen in the digital realm? Like if there's
no,
only one complex pole?
No, you can actually build single sideband systems in the real world.
How do you do it if it only has a single complex pole?
Well, it doesn't.
Oh, okay.
But the principle, the analysis of the system is done using complex analysis.
Do they have to use diodes or something like that?
No, they do. Well, there's a whole discussion about whether, if you ever read like the newsgroups and things, there's often discussions about whether negative frequencies really exist and whether you can have a transfer function that's complex. And you can read some of the newsgroups if you want. We can talk about this stuff for years. So, what we can do with this response is we can model it with what's called a Bode plot. A Bode plot is an asymptotic approximation to the actual frequency response of the system. It's plotted on a log-log scale. In those days, that meant we had to go and get log paper at the bookstore, which we always hated. Today, of course, you don't have to do that, except, I guess, with Smith charts and things like that. But most of it's done on a computer these days. So. But it allows the approximation of the frequency response using straight lines. So what we're going to do, because we have this nice sort of asymptotic behavior, we'll observe that if I take this in the log domain, if I take 20 log 10 of h of g, the magnitude of h of j omega, in this case, that's going to give us log 10 of 1 over omega tau, which is just minus 20 log 10 of omega tau. And if I take the ratio of H of J omega at some frequency to H of J omega at 10 times that frequency, what I actually get then is 20 log 10 or a 20 dB per decade attenuation. So if when with Bode plots, we essentially observe that for a single first order polynomial, I can approximate it with a straight line and then a 20 dB per attenuation, per 20 dB per decade increase in frequency, straight line. So we have the straight line until we get to the critical frequency of 1 over tau, and then we have a straight line with a slope of 20 dB per every increment of 10 on the log scale. Now, in actuality, the plot is a dark line here. It has this curve, and it's down 3 dB at this frequency of 1 over tau. But with the Bode plot, we approximate this as these two straight lines. And then we can do a similar thing for phase. We can plot phase as a function which starts at zero, goes through this transition, and then it's flat again. So we, with phase, we can draw the phase as three straight lines, essentially. Now, this is useful because by the time we're done with this, we can look at a polynomial like a filter and tell you how much attenuation you can get out of that filter. And I'll comment more on that in a moment. But let's look at the infamous second order system. So here we have H of S is omega n squared over S squared plus 2 times zeta times omega sub n times S plus omega n squared. The frequency response of this system, well, we can do this in the log domain and write minus 20, the log of the square root of the denominator. And when omega is much, much greater than omega sub n, we can write this as, well, what does that mean when omega is much, much greater than omega sub n? That means omega over omega sub n is going to be very large, which means we can ignore the 1 here, and we can simplify this to omega squared over omega n squared, quantity squared, and that's because these two terms are essentially the omega over omega sub n, we can ignore the 1 here. So this gives us minus 40 log omega over omega sub n, because we have the square root of this thing squared, so we can pull the square out. And therefore, the Bode plot for this second order system is a straight line until we get to the critical frequency, and then it rolls off at 40 dB per decade. Now, the actual plot, and this is something you should pay attention to in the context of that homework assignment, the actual plot has this little bit of overshoot at the critical frequency, and that overshoot depends on the damping constant zeta. So that's a big hint about the assignment, the X spread assignment. And it's interesting, you notice that that's at the at this frequency omega sub n, the critical frequency of the system. The phase, a little more complicated, the phase changes by a total amount of pi. It starts at zero and it ends at minus pi. So we approximate the phase as a straight line, a sloped line, and then a horizontal line. And only now the phase goes through a total change of pi from 0.1 to 10. Yeah.
So if omega is much, much greater than omega sub n, why does 2 zeta omega over omega n go to 0? Or does the 2 zeta just know? I mean, what?
So here we have omega squared over omega n squared, quantity squared, right?
Right, and that becomes basically just negative omega squared over omega n squared, right?
Well, right, so we ignore the 1, so we have omega to the 4 over omega n to the 4, right?
Okay.
Here we have simply omega squared over omega n squared. So if you have something raised, if you have a positive number like 10 raised to the 4th power, and you add that to 10 raised to the 2nd power, well, that's 10 to the 4th power is, well, 10 to 10,000, and 10 to the 2nd power is 100. You can ignore the 100.
Okay.
So that's a property of the quadratic, of the square. So it's an approximation, but it's a useful approximation because it tells us that a second order polynomial can give us at most 40 dB per decade of attenuation. Now, why is that useful? Well, suppose I come to you as a circuit designer and I say, build me a filter that gives me 100 dB of attenuation, which is actually something you might do if you're building a really high-end audio application. And I tell you the cost constraints, because the marketing people we were talking about earlier promised this to the customer for, you know, 2 cents or 15 cents. You can only do this with one resistor and one capacitor, and I'll give you an inductor just for kicks. Can you do that? Is there some configuration of one resistor, one capacitor, and one inductor that's going to give you 100 dB per decade attenuation? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no, because at best you can get a second order system out of those components. At best you can get only 40 dB per decade. So if you want to build a 100 dB per decade filter, you're going to need
fifth order system?
Can you just two of these twice? Plus a first order system.
Yeah.
So is it just a general rule of thumb that every reactive component gives you 20 dB a decade to roll off if you design it right?
Right.
Okay.
It's 20 dB per sec per order. So if your order is 5, you can get 100 dB per decade. And that's the value of this kind of asymptotic analysis. So here we have an example. We can actually go a little further with this. Here's an example of a transfer function which has a zero in the numerator and then two poles in the denominator. So we can write this as we can convert H of S to H of J omega, and in this case it's sort of convenient to move some of the constants inside the omegas to use kind of a normalized frequency. But we observe that the critical frequencies for this function, we have a zero at 2, we have a pole at 10, and we have a pole at 50. So we can ask the question then, we can actually construct a Bode plot to describe the frequency response without going through all the detailed calculations. We can look at the DC value of this thing when omega is equal to zero, and then we know that the zero in the numerator is going to cause a a rise that looks something like this, and that's going to start at a frequency of 2. The poles are going to cause a decay. One of the poles is going to start at 10, and the second pole is going to start at 50. So then we can combine these three plots, and we can deduce that the frequency response must look something like this. Then it rises due to the zero, then it levels off because the pole and the zero cancel, and then it tails off because now we have the second pole. So this is kind of the neat thing about Bode plots, is you can actually sketch out the frequency response just by looking at the contributions of each of these. Now it is just an approximation, but it's a pretty reasonable approximation. And we can do something for the phase as well. We can look at the phase in terms of the three components and construct the overall change in the phase function. Now, of course, in MATLAB we can compute the exact response, and we show the MATLAB code here for computing that response. We set up this omega in a log. We define the transfer function. We compute the magnitude function, and we can then plot it. We can also do Bode plot in MATLAB. We can actually set up the polynomial directly, and then we can, this should be a zero here, and then we can invoke a function called Bode that produces the Bode plot. So in MATLAB, you can compare the actual response to the Bode plot very easily. But the Bode plot is useful because it allows you to understand some general properties of the transfer function. So here's, in that case, here's an example of a, here's a comparison from MATLAB of the exact response of that system and what the Bode plot predicted. And the Bode plot's pretty close because the frequencies, the zero and the two poles, are reasonably well far apart. So they don't interact. If you get a lot of poles and zeros close together, you'll see a little bit more error in the Bode plot. So let's now talk about the impact of this on filters. So recall that an ideal low-pass filter is a non-causal filter and hence unrealizable. Now, thinking about this from a Bode plot point of view, when I show you a frequency response, which is infinitely sharp, what can you tell me now based on your notions of Bode plots? You cannot really get something this sharp without using an infinitely long impulse response. Because the Bode plot, we say, well, for every order, we get 20 dB per decade. Well, this is infinitely sharp, so you're going to need lots of sections to this filter. So the sharper you want to make the filter, generally speaking, the bigger or the longer the filter has to be, the more sections you have to use in the filter. So that creates that used to create a job opportunity for engineers, because the question then became, if your marketing people tell you this thing can only cost a dollar, you as an engineer say, well, for a dollar I can only get in seven components. What's the sharpest filter I can build for seven components? Now, of course, the marketing people have already printed up the literature that say you get 3,000 dB per decade roll-off in this great filter that you have, but they know as engineers that you know the best you can do is maybe, depending on the components, but you'll be lucky to get probably 50 dB per decade of attenuation out of seven components. Now, another interesting real-world issue about filters is that when you try to build circuits that give you very large amounts of attenuation, and you'll see this when you get into senior design if you try to do this, I used to have a saying that the dynamic range of life is about 80 dB. If you build a circuit and you put that circuit in this room and you measure the attenuation, you're probably going to be lucky to see 80 dB of attenuation in that filter. Even though theoretically you say, well, it should be giving you 100 dB or 120 dB or 140 dB. And the reason for that is that just large amounts of attenuation, any kind of energy you're picking up in the circuit from fluorescent lights or any of that kind of stuff will be seen in the noise floor of that circuit. So it's very hard actually to build circuits with really large amounts of attenuation, because there's always noise problems that ultimately limit the amount of attenuation you're getting out of the circuits. If you want to build really high precision audio equipment that gets that kind of attenuation, there's a lot of little tricks you have to do to do that. But for generally speaking in the lab, you can often, usually you'll be lucky out of discrete components to get more than about 80 dB of attenuation per decade. So you can't certainly build non-ideal filters. The filter design problem then becomes an optimization problem, in which we try to best meet the user's requirements with a filter that can be implemented with the least number of components. This is equivalent to trying to minimize the number of coefficients in the Laplace transfer function. It is also comparable to minimizing the order of the filter. So if the filter design problem in a nutshell is, as a customer, I will tell you, I need a filter that has this frequency response. And your job is to build a filter, to build a circuit that will give you this frequency response. Now this is a paradigm. This was a large part of engineering for many years because we would do this across many different applications. And there's ways, we'll see in a moment, there's ways that you can do this using some very interesting mathematics. Today, fortunately, you can just throw this into a computer and let the computer do all the numerical optimizations, give you the transfer function, and give you the circuit. It can all be done automatically. Typically, the numerator order is less than or equal to the denominator order, so building on the concept of a Bode plot, you can relate the maximum amount of attenuation desired to the order of the denominator in the polynomial. There are often no perfect solutions. Users must trade off design constraints such as passband smoothness, stopband attenuation, and linearity. If you want the filter to attenuate very quickly, you're going to pay by having the passband have a little bit of ripple in it. We'll see that in a moment. That's a common problem in digital audio. You want to make the filter really sharp, you're going to distort the signal in the passband, and audio purists don't like that. So you have to typically choose filter structures that give you flat passbands rather than ripple passbands, and that'll become clearer in a moment. Computer-aided design programs such as those in MATLAB are able to design the filters, and therefore a lot of this can be done automatically. But what I want to do today is to just introduce you to two interesting types of filters. We'll actually talk about three that are based on all that wonderful math that you keep telling me you didn't learn in your first year. But Butterworth, Chebyshev, polynomials, if you ever wonder why you probably haven't even learned these, but you used to learn these things in the olden days. But Butterworth polynomials are used in a lot of different areas of science, and one of the neat things is that they actually form the basis for a filter design approach. So Butterworth filters are maximally flat in the passband, and hence they're very popular with audio systems. Their distinguishing characteristic is that the poles are arranged on a semicircle in the S-plane, in the left-half plane. And the filter function is an all-pole filter that exploits the properties of Butterworth polynomials. The way the polynomial is laid out follows a pattern that's known as a Butterworth polynomial. And if you do that, what you get is a filter that has a flat passband, a relatively flat passband, but then not as much attenuation as you like. So you trade flatness in the passband for attenuation in the transition band. So the design strategy then is to select the cutoff frequency and the amount of attenuation you want. That determines the order. Sorry about that. You determine the amount of attenuation you want. That gives you the order, and then you can compute the order of the polynomial, and then you can synthesize the circuit that corresponds to that order of the polynomial. In the olden days, there used to be big books in the library that had all these polynomials tabulated. It was really crazy, but just people would make a living out of this kind of thing. Today, of course, it's all done on computers with software and such, and that's a good thing. But the theory is important. The theory, I think, is more important than detail. So because it actually shows you how mathematics plays into real-world concepts like filtering, and I think that's what's really neat about math in engineering, is that Butterworth and Chebyshev conceived of these things long before we had the discipline of electrical engineering, but yet we're using these concepts in electrical engineering. They have some kind of a fundamental meaning or value in electrical engineering. Chebyshev filter is based on Chebyshev polynomials, not surprisingly, which these allow ripple in the passband to achieve greater attenuation in the transition band. So this implies a lower filter order at the expense of smoothness of the frequency response in the passband. Chebyshev filters have a transfer function which uses a Chebyshev polynomial, and I'm not even going to attempt to tell you what that is. There's a nice little recursion to compute this, but the bottom line here is that again, you decide how much attenuation you want. That tells you the order of the Chebyshev polynomial, and then you can get the corresponding transfer function, and then from the transfer function you can get the corresponding circuit. So here we have an example of some Chebyshev filters, a second two-pole filter, a three-pole filter, a five-pole filter, and here we have a comparison of a Chebyshev to a Butterworth, the same order filter. And you see the Chebyshev gives you more attenuation, but you get a lot more ripple in the passband. So Chebyshevs are not good for audio, because this would be distortion to the music that you're hearing, the passband, but you get this nice anti-aliasing property. So digital audio tends to prefer filters which are flatter in the passband, and then you just need a bigger, higher order filter. Now you might think, well, I have one filter which is smooth, I have one filter which has ripple, what if I allow ripple in both the passband and the stopband? Can I get a sharper filter? And that's actually what's known as an elliptic filter, and it's based on properties of elliptic polynomials. I thought I had a slide on that, I guess not. But the elliptic filters are actually used in a lot of consumer applications, because you can get a really good low-pass filter at a very low order, but you have a little bit of distortion in the passband and in the stopband. They have ripple. And in low-end consumer applications, that's okay. Elliptic filters were used early on for the anti-aliasing filters in CD players, because they were inexpensive and you got a pretty sharp filter, but they introduced a little bit of audio distortion. Now you might ask, well, we've spent all this time talking about low-pass filters, why haven't we talked about other kinds of filters? Well, the neat thing is, if you start with a low-pass filter design, once you have a low-pass filter, you can transform it to a high-pass filter or a band-pass filter using very simple frequency transformations. So there's two general approaches to filter design. One is the direct optimization of the response using a tool like MATLAB. The other is to start with the low-pass filter design, get the filter, and then transform it into either a band-pass filter or a high-pass filter. The latter approach can be achieved by using these transformations. If you take the low-pass transfer function, H of S, and everywhere where there's an S, you substitute S times omega 1 over omega 2, where omega 1 and omega 2 represent omega 2 is the new low cutoff frequency, omega 1 is the old cutoff frequency. Then you can essentially change the low pass, the cutoff frequency at which the low pass filter terminates. So what we'll do is we'll design the filter to always have a cutoff frequency at 1 hertz. And then we'll use this transformation to move that cutoff frequency to whatever actual frequency that we want. So most filter design is done using normalized frequency. And then once you've got that filter at normalized frequency, you can then transform it to the actual frequency that you're interested in. And again, the computer tools will do this automatically for you. You can similarly convert a low-pass filter into a high-pass filter by essentially everywhere where there's an S, changing it to 1 over S. And then even more interestingly, you can convert a low-pass filter into a band-pass filter by simply replacing S. Everywhere where there's an S, you can replace it with this polynomial S squared plus omega 1 omega 2 divided by S times omega 2 minus omega 1, where omega 1 and omega 2 are essentially relate to the passband of the filter omega 1 and omega 2. So this is just what's called the frequency transformation approach to designing filters. So what we've shown with this in this section is that we can take a first or second order filter, and we can approximate its frequency response using Bode plots, and then you can compute a frequency response of more complicated filters by simply analyzing them as the cascade of these first and second order sections. That's why we spend so much time studying the properties of first and second order systems. They're essentially a building block which we can use to build the response and understanding of higher order systems. And then we've introduced some specific filter design prototypes. We've talked about how you can design filters to arbitrary specifications using these prototypes like Butterworth or Chebyshev or elliptical filters. And often that's done by designing a low-pass filtered version of the system. So if, for example, your goal is a filter that has a cutoff frequency at 1,000 hertz, what you'll do is you'll design this first with a filter that has a cutoff frequency at 1 hertz, because this you can actually look up in a table. People have tabulated the filters that correspond to a normalized Butterworth polynomial that has a cutoff frequency of 1 hertz. And then once you have this filter, you can transform it to this filter using our transformations. Or you can transform this to a bandpass filter, again, by just using the transformation where we go from a low pass to a bandpass. So most filter design, when you're using these kinds of prototypes, is actually done on a low pass shape at a normalized frequency of 1. And then the filters transform to these other frequencies. Now in MATLAB you have a lot of really powerful tools to do this. In fact, in MATLAB there's a program that will let you specify arbitrary frequencies. You specify the gain as a function of frequency, and you can then run the program and it will give you the filter, the H of S, that corresponds to that shape. And you can control how accurately it models this. If you want to use a simple version of this, you'll get a low order filter. If you want to use a really precise version of this, you're going to get a much higher order filter. And then once you have the H of S, then you can throw it into a circuit synthesizer that will generate actual filter for you. And you can do that with active components, passive components. You have a lot of flexibility with the design tools. And this is a whole industry based on this. And then what's even more interesting is that you can hit a button and it will generate DSP code or microprocessor code for you that implements that filter. So what used to be the job of, you could say, a digital signal processing engineer, a lot of this now has been automated, even the code generation part of it. But you as the system designer are the one who's going to have to decide what the appropriate specification is to meet the requirements of the application and to minimize the complexity or the cost or the speed or whatever design parameters you're operating under. That's where the engineering comes in today. That's the creative part, that's the job that pays the good money, because you're the person, you're the application engineer actually solving the problem for the customer. And that's why, you know, it's important. One thing we get out of this class is that you're not afraid to go to MATLAB and verify and actually design within MATLAB, because that's going to be a tool that you'll use to generate these solutions.
Something I've always wondered, and I don't think I've ever got a really good answer for, is since MATLAB and simulation software is so important, why don't they offer a class here to give a stronger foundation in it?
We used to teach that class and the students hated it.
Not surprised.
So we stopped teaching it. That's what?
Not surprised. They hated it. The students hated class about MATLAB.
So it was decided it was better to introduce it and integrate it into the curriculum. So I actually taught, when I first arrived here in 94, I taught a class. We used to meet once a week at night on computer tools and introduced a lot of all these computer tools. It was actually a lot of fun. But until you, the problem is when you teach it in an isolated way, then the students pretty much forget it when you walk out of the class. You have to actually use this stuff. So that's what we try to do in this class. And as we introduce these things, get you to do them in MATLAB.
Well, it seems like the way they approach it now is, you know, just give you an assignment, and you're just supposed to, like, contact the magical MATLAB Perry.
No, because, I mean, we're showing you the actual MATLAB code to solve most of the problems.
Well, this class is, but a lot of classes, they don't.
Well,
yeah. Me and my whole Circus 2 class failed our final because he had us design a filter, a Butterworm filter, and only showed the code twice the whole semester.
I refuse to comment. I hear your pain. I try to provide a lot of support in this class so that it's not a big deal to do software pieces of this. But in general, with computer tools, your network of friends, as you probably know, is the most important thing. Don't ever spend time, you know, trying to figure something out. Just to find somebody who knows how to do that and get the answer from them. That's the way you generally learn in this kind of a world. So,
I'm not sure if you're being sarcastic or not.
No, I'm being
truthful. April 1, we can't believe anything
when
you
say. When I have a problem, I call a friend. My network of friends, you're going to learn this as engineers. Your network of friends, that's part of your value as an engineer. Well, because most problems you encounter are going to be outside of your major area of expertise.
I believe you guys. Find it funny to hear, like, no, next time you don't know how to do something, just ask somebody who already knows how to do it.
Usually so I try to get you to study groups in this class. That's another thing. When I started teaching this class many years ago, students love to torture themselves by their, individually, struggling at home or in the library late at night. That's crazy. Get together as a group. Everyone knows how to do something and pull all that knowledge together and...
I don't think you can get through engineering if you don't
want
to do that.
We used to meet, when I was a student, I was at a commuter school, so we'd meet for breakfast, kind of, when everyone would get to school, and we'd all compare things on the homework. And it was hilarious, because it was like, okay, who knows how to do this problem, and who knows how to do that problem, and okay, I'll trade you this solution for that solution. And then it was sort of a competition, and all that. But it was the group that I was with, we all were really good students, but we all shared and taught each other, and that was a really valuable part, because now, these days, as a senior person in engineering, when somebody asks me something I don't know, I just go send an email to my friends and find someone who knows the answer to that. And then I send you guys an email, and I look really smart because I know all this stuff.
Yeah.
Probably that was somebody else who gave me all that information.
I wanted to ask you about my solution. If I was...